Assalamu alaikum. Today we are talking to Dr. Shehnaz Haqqani, who's an assistant professor of religion at Mercer University. She specializes in Islam with a focus on gender and sexuality. We talk about the stereotypes that are attached to Pashtun women by non-Pashtun Muslims at large. We talk about the myth of equating Islam and patriarchy and how religions are really formed. Dr. Haqqani is the co-founder of Feminist Islamic Troubles of North America, or Fitna, with Zahra Khan, and she's the force behind the YouTube channel called What the Patriarchy. Before we begin, I must urge you to please share this episode with friends and family, but more importantly, please, please review the podcast. This allows algorithms to pick up the podcast and make it visible to other folks with similar interest. Please support the work of Muslim women in academia by liking, reviewing, and sharing this podcast. Now let's turn to Dr. Shehnaz Haqqani. Assalamu alaikum, Shehnaz.
Alaikum assalam. How are you, Safa?
Alhamdulillah. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me. This is really exciting. Excellent podcast.
I'm so excited to have you on because you do a lot of public-facing work, which you're going to talk about. But I just wanted to start off with asking you, how did you decide to pursue a PhD and what has made you choose academia?
So I want to say, like many South Asians, I was supposed to become a medical doctor, an MD, so my parents are not impressed. But I was a pre-med student in college, and I did not think the humanities were important at all. I had no respect for them, which I know is a terrible thing. But I know better now. I think the humanities are incredibly important, and I'm in them now. But so I only took the humanities courses because I had to for graduation. But then I took a history of, I think it was a history of the Middle East course, and it was by accident. It was a summer course. I was just trying to fill in my general education requirements. And it was taught by somebody who was he had a PhD in Islamic studies. This is Devon Stewart from Emory University. I so much respect for him. And I love it when teachers go off on tangents, which frankly are seldom irrelevant, I think. But this teacher did that so many times. And I was a devoted practicing Muslim. I practiced Islam and I still do. But I did it. I practiced it very differently back then than I do now because I know a lot more things that I didn't know back then. And then he would make these comments about Islam and Islamic law because he knew how Islamic law had developed. He knew Muslim cultures. He'd been doing this for decades. But especially his comments on Islam and gender, they were such a challenge for me. And I would try to correct him, and I would correct him in class, which now being a teacher, being a professor myself, it's, oh my God, I can't believe how much patience he had with me. But I would try to debate him. I would go to his office hours, for hours and hours, and I would debate him. And he was so, so compassionate, and he was so patient. And he would often make his response to much of what I would say was things like, I'm not convinced. And it just became this, and I was like, whoa, this is incredible. Stuff that I'm very embarrassed about now. But I would try to debate him, and I contact, he knows this. I tell him this all the time. I'm so grateful, and he's still in my life. He's a mentor. He's important to me. And so he would keep recommending books to me. He would keep recommending ideas to me. He would try to challenge me and encourage me to consider alternatives to what I knew or what I had grown up with. And I think some of his points, and he didn't express them this way, but was that Islam is so complex. That it's not with like any religions, it's not as simple as we imagine religion to be, as we're taught it is, right? Mm-hmm. That religions take a very long time, centuries to develop, that there are multiple opinions that are presented in the beginning, and some opinions win, some opinions lose, mm-hmm. that Islam doesn't emerge in a vacuum, and that, literally any question that we might have about Islam, what does Islam say about X? What does it say about Y? The answer ultimately depends on very specific contexts, and that the responses to those are, rooted in something specific that humans are going through. So it took me such a long time to understand this. And I want to say only recently in grad school. And I'm so grateful to all of that. And I remember then losing all of my interest and passion in any of my science courses. And so I declared a Middle Eastern and South Asian Studies major at Emory, and I have never looked back. I think I'm happiest since then. I still went ahead and took all the pre-med courses because I was like, just in case, and I think I stop at Orgo 2 though. But by then, I was perfectly sure I wasn't going to do anything in medicine. I guess just to specifically answer the question or to more directly answer it, I chose a PhD because learning the value of the undergraduate, of the humanities courses was incredibly empowering for me. It was so thought-provoking. And the ways that it challenged me, I want my students to be challenged in the same ways. I felt betrayed by everything that I had learned about religion, about Islam. I didn't know that there were alternatives. There were things that I knew or things that I believed in that I was troubled by, but didn't know that I could question them, that there were alternative possibilities available to me, and that they were just as Islamic as the ones that I had grown up with. And so I wanted to explore those questions more, in a way that would empower me enough and give me the training and the resources to answer more questions like that, or to explore those questions, I guess, in depth. So the PhD route was the best option for that, and I have no regrets. There were also a bunch of personal reasons, but I would say that being an academic allows me to do for my students, I hope, probably one student of thousands, I guess, I would like to do for my students what my teacher did for me. And it has been the most freeing, the most liberating thing, the most empowering thing to know that there's always options, that religions are interpreted. And I think that the PhD and the academy is what's allowed me to think that way. So that's why I'm in academia.
That's such a beautiful understanding of Islam. I love it. And that's exactly how I think about it as well. And it's so beautiful that you want to convey that heterogeneity within Islam to your students as well. I mean, that's definitely my aim when I teach Islamic thought. And it's such a hard aim to convey. And it's amazing when we have professors who can model that for us so that we can implement it as well. That's beautiful.
And also, I mean, we're so vulnerable at that age. And the undergraduate years we're so vulnerable, right? Like, we are just developing now intellectually and otherwise. And we have to be so careful with students. And my teacher was so careful with me, right? Like, because he had this huge impact on me. And I think about where I would be if I didn't have him, if I had a teacher who was a lot more closed-minded, or if I had a teacher who would just tell me I was annoying, right? But this teacher didn't do that with me. He just let me go on and on and on. And I've sent him so many emails thanking him, because I just don't think I can thank him enough. So I'm hoping that I can do something like that, like sort of the learning and the unlearning that can happen at that very vulnerable stage in our lives. So I'm hoping to do that for students. I don't know that I do, but I am sure
you do. I'm sure. I have a feeling that, yeah, you're definitely doing that for your students. I want to shift topics to a paper that you wrote on Pashtun women and the internet. Who are the Pashtun for people who do not know?
So I'm Pashtun. Pashtuns are an ethnic group of humans in Pakistan, and we're a minority there. And that's where I'm from. I'm from Swat, Pakistan. I was born there. And also in Afghanistan. So in Afghanistan, we're the majority. Thanks to colonialism, because, you know, that existed. But it divided up. So colonialism in British colonialism in South Asia divided us up. So the borders were created both, you know, with the partition of India, but also before that. And you know, we're now divided up in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And the language is developing differently in both, or dialects are developing, cultures developing in different ways. The food even is developing in different ways. But that's who we are. We're an ethnic group of, we speak Pashto. That's our native language. It's also known as Pukhto. The KH and the SH is a dialectical thing, or southern and northern thing. We're also known as Pathans or Afghans or Pukhtuns, which is a variant of Pashtun. So that's us.
So what are some of the general assumptions that people have about the Pashtun women, and what role does the internet play in countering these assumptions, in retaining their sense of culture, but also their political voice?
You know, the irony is that the general assumptions about Pashtun women by non-Pashtun Muslims, non-Pashtun Pakistanis, non-Pashtun Afghans, non-Pashtun South Asians are literally identical to what non-Muslims or Westerners have about Muslim women. So things like, you know, we're submissive. Pashtun women are submissive to men. We're enslaved by our husbands and fathers and brothers. That honor killing is a common thing for women. That we have to literally fight and we die for education, you know, because Malala. And it's amazing to me. I mean, I know so many academics of Muslim and South Asian backgrounds who should know better, but they are like, they're shocked when they hear that I'm Pashtun, and they have no shame in telling me in my face that I'm an oxymoron, that they explicitly ask me questions like, oh my God, how was it like fighting your dad to allow you to go to school? And I'm just like, who the hell do you think you are? Because aren't we denied education? Aren't we oppressed? Literally, I get asked, what did you have to do to fight your dad to let you get the PhD? And I didn't.
Oh my God.
I mean, if I sat here and tell you my dad's story, like the way that he values education, like he's always told us we came to the US for an education, you know, for a better education, because he wanted opportunities for us that would not be available to us in the villages that we grew up in. It's amazing that these are academics who ask me these questions. And it doesn't help that in the same way that Western media, you know, reinforces and just keeps on contributing to these assumptions about Muslim women, Pakistani media, South Asian media, I mean, Bollywood, for example, and Pakistani TV shows and serials, the way that they represent or portray the Pashtun woman as submissive, she's quiet, her hair is always covered. And you know that the only woman who covers her head in Pakistani TV shows is the woman who's poor and, you know, oppressed and modest, right? The educated woman somehow never covers her hair. So
yeah.
There's just no nuance. And so Pakistani media doesn't help. And it's just ironic to me how identical these are. I used to write a lot about this when I was blogging. I had a blog where, you know, mostly I would cover Pashtun issues in the beginning. But now I've sort of I've moved on to Islam and I don't do Pashtun stuff as much. But all of that to say that these stereotypes about Pashtun women are just as false as they are, you know, as Western stereotypes about Muslim women are. But they are reinforced in the exact same ways. And it's just, I find it ironic. And then the internet, I think, has been somewhat helpful. I think the article or the writing that you're referring to is a chapter that I wrote in a book called Political Muslims. And it's a chapter in which I explore Pashtun women bloggers and the ways that they use social media as a platform for change. How they're basically raising their voice for political gains, for political purposes, how they are demanding that they and resisting the, you know, stereotypes against them. It was primarily about Pashtun women bloggers and how they're sort of enacting or contributing to changes that can be made, both about the ways that they're understood, because it's their voice. And these women are located all over the world. The ones who are based in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, but also in Europe and North America and so on. And I'm not as up to date on this issue because I've paused my research on Pashtuns a couple of years into grad school. And I'm focusing a lot more on Islam and gender stuff since then. But this social media is an excellent, excellent place to look for what Muslim women themselves, but in this case, Pashtun women themselves are saying, because they are so active and they're actually respected. Like they are invited to TV shows, talk shows, you know, podcasts, radio, they're interviewed all over and they have really powerful voices and they're really, really brilliant. And it's an excellent way where we can see, oh, okay, so all of the assumptions that I have about the Pashtun women are too simplistic and they cannot be true, that there's a lot more nuance.
Speaking of how Muslims are often seen, I wanted to ask you, why do some Muslims have grievances or issues with the concept of feminism? Do you think there are any legitimate grievances or does it all boil down to patriarchy?
Oh, there are many, many reasons why they have grievances. I do believe some of the grievances are very legitimate, but I don't think that many others are. So I think it's, and I've been thinking a lot about this. Interestingly, a lot of Muslims we've internalized the idea that Islam is so inherently patriarchal, which is, I think, hilarious. And so for this kind of Muslims, the Muslims that have internalized the idea that it's inherently patriarchal, when they ask a question about Islam, like what does Islam say about XYZ, if the answer doesn't sound patriarchal, mm-hmm. then their response seems to be, is that even Islamic then? Because like mm-hmm. And I've fallen into that in my earlier stages of sort of becoming a feminist and appreciating feminism, Islamic feminism in particular. I used to think the same way. This doesn't sound Islamic, and Islamic somehow is on the connotation with Islamic. There is basically patriarchy, right? And I think an excellent example is female-led prayer, which is something that I work on. The question of can Muslim women lead mixed gender prayer, not just women but other people too. And we've grown up to the idea that it's not allowed, that women are not allowed to lead mixed gender prayers. So we can't imagine it being allowed. But the reality and the facts are that the Islamic tradition actually does allow it. There are several possible answers to the question of can women lead prayers? And one of those answers is yes, they can lead men in prayers without any conditions, without any qualifications. So whatever the conditions are for men who lead, those conditions are the same for women. Someone like Tabari and several others were totally okay with it. But this idea is not very well known. And one of the reasons I think that many Muslims are resistant then to allowing women to lead prayers is that it just sounds too feminist. It sounds like women are just competing with, by the way, a lack of understanding of feminism. So it sounds like women are just competing with men and they, you know, that we just want what men have. That's mm-hmm. not what's happening at all. But something like that, that kind of a grievance, I think is definitely rooted in patriarchy. And it's basically a hate for women's gender equality or allowing women to have the same privileges or equal access to anything that men might have. But for other Muslims, you know, and this is an example, I guess, of a legitimate grievance. It's also about the fact that Western feminism has harmed us so much of the world in really, really traumatic and significant ways. We know that feminist values are weaponized against Muslim women. Feminism was used or exploited, I guess, to morally justify colonialism. We've seen it justify, you know, current existing wars right now. This is why we invaded Afghanistan. But we know that ultimately no one has ever cared about the Muslim woman. It was never about the Muslim woman, and it was never about our rights or freedom. I mean, we know that neither colonialists nor the imperialists and also not Muslim male intellectuals, they don't care about us. Women just have been used as a means to an end. They were tools to address particular political and social anxieties that these men in power had. And Muslims aren't the only ones that have grievances with feminism, right? So people of color, generally, a lot of Black women refuse to identify as feminist. Latinx women have refused to identify as feminist. The word womanist, in fact, was coined precisely in response to Western white, what, upper class, exclusionary, anti-intersectional feminism, which never cared about the Black woman, the poor woman, the colonized woman, the enslaved woman. Now, but I have opinions on when Muslims in particular, or I guess people of color, non-Black people of color generally, respond to feminism by completely dismissing it as a Western thing, because, I mean, it's not, certainly not, it was not invented by, I think it is so funny. And it is so intellectually dishonest, and it's so ironic that the idea of gender equality could ever be considered an invention of the West. Because do we know nothing about the West and the ways that it like traumatizes the woman? Like, it has no respect for the woman. We've always hated women in the West, right? Like, it goes back to like ancient times. I mean, if Aristotle, like his views on women, like, it's very important to me to identify feminism, that we be very clear about what we mean when we use the word feminism. Mm-hmm. My feminism, for example, is intersectional. It is anti-patriarchy in all its forms. It's anti-classist. It's anti-war. It includes justice for LGBTQ+ people. It includes justice for poor people. So, right. I mean, at least I aim towards that. I recognize that I'm not always successful in achieving this. But I think that as long as when somebody says, what do you think about feminism, or what do you think feminism is doing? My first question is always define feminism. And then I will tell you what it is. And I'll tell you if it's good, and I'll tell you if it's bad. Because if it's going to be founded on any exclusion whatsoever, then it's going to be objectively bad, in my opinion.
Yeah. Speaking about this idea that feminism arises from Western thought or something like that, what would you want Muslim ulama or Muslim scholars to know about Islamic feminism in particular?
Oh my God, so much. I want them to, so the Muslim ulama are, you know, this male, in this case, or traditionally anyway, male scholars who are traditionally trained in the study of Islam and for decades and decades and so on. I want them to understand Islamic feminism. I want them to listen to Muslim feminists. I want them to listen to literally any Muslim woman, period. I want them to read the works of Muslim feminists. I want them to engage with us intellectually the way that we do with them, because we're constantly engaging their works, but they don't, it's not it reciprocated whatsoever. I want them to recognize that Islamic feminism is, or it can be, just as legitimate as whatever its alternatives are. So these, the ulama's opinions, which are seldom feminist. I want them to recognize that the way that they tend to define Islam is exclusionary. it's unjust. It's often very harmful to women, to the LGBTQ people, to people who are excluded from participating in fiqh, right? So Islamic jurisprudence developments. We were excluded from anything, from developing the Sharia, the way that men, a particular class and a group of men were not excluded. I want them to recognize that it's not the Islam that they're talking about is not the religion of God, that they're using the word Islam to mean their own opinions and the opinions of other men. Now, granted, if they hear me say this, they're just going to stop listening to me because they're going to accuse me of all kinds of things.
I mean, they're going to say that this is your opinion, but what they're not recognizing is what they're saying is their opinion.
That's exactly my point. Like, these are my interpretations are just as legitimate as theirs. I mean, Muslim feminists have done such remarkable research. Like, I think about that, and I'm so grateful to be living in a time that Muslim feminists exist, right? And that they have a kind of platform. I wish that it was a lot more mainstream, but I'm so glad to have access to their materials. I want the ulama to stop dismissing us. I want them to stop dismissing what we have to say, and I want them to stop accusing us of being non-Muslim, which is I get that all the time. I get called the cancer of the Muslim community. I get called all kinds of things, right? I'm accused of supposedly being influenced by Westerners. Mm-hmm. Right, they imagine that feminism is a Western import, it's a Western thing, and I again think that's laughable. Like, do you know anything about Western feminism? Do you know anything about the West period? Like, I'm so critical of the way that the West treats women. Like, have you any idea what the conversation and abortion is like, right, in the US at least? It's just giving credit to the West for things that it does not deserve credit for. But it's really unfair. And when I was doing my research for my dissertation, I remember one of the questions that I asked and it was on Islamic feminism. A part of it was in Islamic feminism. Then we were asking my interlocutors, my research participants, questions like, you know, tell me about the Prophet Muhammad, like his views on women, etc. And they, most of them, had no problem identifying him as a feminist. They would even say, oh, he's definitely a feminist. And they would often, you know, qualify it with things like, for his context, he did X, Y, Z. He did so much for women. Even if they themselves were hesitant to define themselves as feminist, identify themselves as feminist. So feminism, I want the ulama to recognize that feminism is not a bad word. It doesn't have to be a bad word. That wanting justice, associating justice with the West is very problematic because it makes a statement about Islam as being inherently unjust. And that to make it just, you have to be influenced by the West. And I think that's deeply problematic.
Yeah. Right. You also have a chapter on teaching Islam and gender. So this is a class you teach. Can you tell us about some of your experiences of teaching the subject?
Yeah. So I teach classes in religion generally, and I've also taught courses on Islamophobia. But one of my favorite, most favorite classes to teach is Islam and gender, which I'm also teaching this semester. And I was just talking with a colleague about this, a colleague who also teaches Islam and gender, and she's at a different institution. And I was telling her about some of my challenges in teaching about Islam. I think that as scholars of religion, but I think as academics generally, I don't think we talk about this issue enough, that teaching about Islam in a context of white supremacy, in a context of racism, in a context of Islamophobia is an incredibly challenging thing. And it poses particular dilemmas for us. In other words, by moral dilemmas, I mean, if I have this burden of teaching Islam in a particular way, if I give my students or if I introduce my students to the wrong idea, if I do this wrong, my students can leave this class with the idea that Islam is so patriarchal and that Muslim women are so oppressed, which, you know, of course, are biases that unfortunately many of our students are already coming to class with, that they might end up supporting and endorsing and maybe even initiating imperialism and invasions of Muslim communities. And they might go to wars with Muslims. And because, you know, the idea that we're just trying to save Muslim women is sold to us in such beautiful, powerful packages. Like, it's so convincing somehow. And so for me, the presence of Islamophobia shapes very much the conversations that we're going to have in our class, the kinds of topics that we'll cover, the materials that we'll teach in our classes, the books that we'll teach. So I don't often get to what I want to talk about. I don't often get to, you know, I can't teach an Islam and gender class in the context of Islamophobia to a group of non-Muslims the way that I would talk about it or teach it to a group of Muslims. I wish that wasn't the case, but it becomes a moral dilemma. I have to be extremely careful because a lot of these students are coming to class with assumptions that are unfortunately very problematic. I'm teaching this class a semester, and I'm currently having to completely restructure the class in accordance with the assumptions, right, that I just mentioned that students are coming with, which, you know, is this idea that colonialism maybe wasn't so bad, that Muslim women are oppressed and somehow Muslim women is a category and oppression is not being defined clearly. They questions like maybe other religions are bad too, but why does Islam seem so much worse, right?
Right.
So I'm spending my weekend having to redesign my syllabus to address some of these issues. Mm. And I will end up having to focus a lot more on the ways that Muslim women or the Muslim woman is talked about in the Western media and why that is and how it came to be that way and why that's inappropriate, which for me, I don't like that because I want to be able to talk about the challenges that Muslim women face in talking about female-led prayer. Right. I want them to talk about some of the specific issues and specific themes that are essential to understanding how Islam and gender works. But I can't do that because there are other issues that I have to cover first. And so I wrote this chapter in the book on, you know, teaching Islam in the age of ISIS and Islamophobia. I wrote this partly to, I guess, publicly recognize that, my God, teaching about Islam and gender in the age of Islamophobia is a huge struggle that I don't think we're talking about enough, that it's not being addressed sufficiently. And also to share with other educators some of what has worked for me in teaching about Islam and gender that I hope that they will find helpful as well.
Yes, it was definitely quite a helpful chapter. I mean, the book overall is an excellent book. I recommend it to people to look it up. I want to talk a little bit about your public-facing work because I am quite in awe of it. I admire it a lot. I know you co-founded this online community called Feminist Islamic Troublemakers of North America, the acronym for which would be FITNA. Why did you call it FITNA? I have a feeling, though, I know. But what was the idea behind starting this online community and how has it panned out for you?
So for those of your audience who don't know what FITNA is, it's an Arabic term that has many different translations, but it can mean troublemaking, right? So I love that word. Good troublemaking, basically, right? So it can mean troublemaking, it can mean chaos, it can mean civil war, it can mean a bunch of different things, right? Mm-hmm. But for us, we took the meaning of troublemaking. The woman, by the way, in patriarchy historically has been identified as a fitna. Like we were the source of fitna, we were the source of social chaos in society. Right. It's a part of why we gotta be as covered as possible and be as hidden as possible. So my friend, and I have to give credit to Zahra Khan for this, because she is the brain, she's the main brain behind FITNA for the name, the acronym, the reason and everything. She once, we had a joke on Facebook. I think I was talking about the lack of platforms that are available to Muslim feminists where we can have these conversations on Islam, honest conversations on Islam and gender and the need for some kind of a community, right? And so she joked and said that she one day she's going to have something called FITNA and she can't wait to see the look on somebody's face when she tells them, oh yeah, I'm going to the 7th annual FITNA conference, right? And it was a joke at it and we were all laughing. And next thing I know, she literally started the group, the Facebook group. And it's this amazing community. I love it. It's this community. It's open to everybody. You don't have to be Muslim to join. We have some 6,000 members so far. And the idea is to have a platform for Muslim women, feminist or not, but for Muslim women anywhere in the world. We use North America in it because it's the only way to make the acronym FITNA, right? Mm. But we wanted to have a community for some kind of a space for Muslim women to be able to talk about the questions that they have, to challenge some of the ways that traditionalist Islam or mainstream Islam, you know, deals with questions of gender, questions of women, questions of sexuality that affects us on very, very human levels. And the idea is to mainstream Islamic feminism, basically. So we have all kinds of wonderful goals, but we need money, basically, and resources to make that possible. And we need time. She and I both have full-time jobs, so it's very hard to do that. But we do our best currently. The idea is to have, so we did have a conference, a FITNA conference, actually. We've had one with the very first year that we started in 2016. We had a conference in Boston. It was at MIT. And they loved the idea of FITNA. They loved the way that we were trying to reclaim the word FITNA. And it was successful. It was great. We want to work on very, very grassroots levels as well. We want to work with communities. We're encouraging Muslims around the world to have a FITNA conference, you know, to make it as community-based as possible. And we try to have, in that conference, we try to have only locals. organizing and speaking on whatever panels we had. The questions we asked when we put people in groups, because we had a great attendance, you know, we wanted to address actual local community concerns related to Muslims in that particular community. So the idea is to provide Muslim women with this space that not just Muslim women, non-binary folks, queer Muslims, LGBTQ plus folks in general, and it's done some remarkable things. We have a great audience, and all kinds of discussions are raised there. I mean, it's been fantastic. I've loved it. I've enjoyed it very much. And I highly recommend that people join that, especially if you're looking for some kind of a community as a Muslim feminist.
I'm definitely coming to the next Fitna conference, wherever that is. I definitely enjoy reading the post on it as well. I also know that you vlog and you have a YouTube channel called What the Patriarchy. Why did you start this channel, and what sort of topics do you feel must be covered when you're talking about patriarchy?
So basically, I know stuff, and I needed a platform that was run by me, like not censored by anyone else, because, you know, that happens.
Can I just pause? I love that you just said, I know stuff, because, you know, you do know stuff, and you're like, this is something people need to know. So I'm so glad that you said that and that you're doing it. Go ahead. Sorry.
That's it. No, that's it. That's exact. I know stuff, and I wanted a platform where I could share this with people. So What the Patriarchy is not with Fitna, but it has very similar aims. I want to contribute to mainstreaming Islamic feminism. I want to contribute to mainstreaming a just and compassionate approach to thinking and practicing Islam, thinking about Islam and practicing, because it's possible and people don't know that. Not just Muslims, but also non-Muslims don't know that either. But I get emails from Muslim women, and I used to get this when I was blogging a lot more. I don't blog as much, but I get Muslim women sending me all kinds of questions. And then in some cases, like, we become very close, we call each other, and they cry to me about the kinds of questions they have and the struggles that they have. And they don't know that, hey, that's patriarchy, that's not Islam, right? Or I have and I'm very open about this, I have a very specific idea of what Islam is and is not, and patriarchy is not it, right? There are ways to interpret and practice Islam in patriarchal ways, and we've seen what the impact of that is, but also in anti-patriarchal ways. And so I want my audiences to know that that's possible. The other reason I also started this was that I love assigning stuff in my classes that's not just reading. We all have all kinds of students, right? We have the students who are better visual learners. We have students who listen better than they read, by reading, as in, you know, for all kinds of reasons. So every time I would look up something on YouTube that I could show in my classes, I mean, with very, like, one or two exceptions, everything is by men. And a very, very particular kind of men. And I'm sick of that. And these are men who are saying very problematic things. And it's so troubling. And I will never show those. I mean, I would show that stuff in my class so that we can interrogate it and sort of tear it apart, right? To deconstruct those claims. But never just to be like, okay, here, this is a Muslim opinion. This is Muslim, or this is Islam kind of things. And I highly encourage anybody who has the personality for creating videos, anybody who has the time and the resources to make something like this, please do so, because your voice is needed. Your face is needed. I wanted something that would have a brown woman, you know, talking about Islam authoritatively. I wanted something that has a black woman talking about Islam authoritatively. I need that. And I mean, it was so rare. I only started this last April in Ramadan. May God continue to bless it. But inshallah. I haven't assigned my own videos in my class, and I know that there are resources for other people. You know, this thing happened, by the way, last in July, I think it was. One of my videos is on menstruation. I talk about the fact that people who have written in the Islamic tradition about menstruation never menstruated themselves, right? And they're talking about what is and is not menstruation, and what makes a woman pure and impure and things like that. And I complicate their assumptions about menstruation and their claims about menstruation. And I talk about the menstrual cup and the tampon and the way that these new products that we have that were not available to us in, like, between the 7th and 15th centuries, or really until very recently, and how that should challenge our ideas of what is and is not purity. And some of my male colleagues, wonderful allies and friends of mine, who posted links to my channel, and one of them specifically to the video on menstruation, in this academic Islam listserv. And the response was, oh my God, the responses from Muslim men academics was just really, really terrible. So,
oh no,
it started. And this is another reason why I have to say, this is why I do what I do. So one man responded, and this is, if you're on that listserv, which has over 900 people, from what I understand, then this is kind of public knowledge. Everybody knows about it by now. It was a conversation for weeks. But what the first Muslim man to respond says, he's like, I haven't watched the full video, so forgive me, but here's where she's wrong. So he criticizes me. He says he's watched 1 minute of it, and he has criticism to say on it. I thought about responding to this person privately to say, hey, this is inappropriate. That's like somebody responding to your article or book without reading it. So that's not okay. I'm not going to take you seriously. I just want to privately tell you that looks very unprofessional and wrong. Don't do that ever again to anyone.
Right.
And they also know I'm a junior scholar. I just graduated in like 3 years ago. And then the next person responded, also a Muslim male academic, this one white. And he responds to that person, to the first person, without engaging the content of my video whatsoever. And says, oh yeah, I haven't watched the video either, but she's wrong, ABC. And he goes on and on.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
The mansplaining, it was so ironic. And I'm watching and I'm like, wow, everybody's laughing. And I'm getting all these emails from allies on that group who are emailing me in support, who are telling me, you know, oh my God, this is ridiculous. I got people telling me you should respond to this, and they're giving me tips for how to respond and things like that. Then another person responds, and as I suspected, they're all in conversation with each other, and I'm no longer in the
allies that were responding to you, were they responding to you in private, or did they publicly
private.
Say they're so, oh my, why, private. why, come on.
Some of them, because they themselves are junior scholars, but the good thing is that after the third man responded, and this is happening like within just a few hours, after the third person responds, the third man responds, finally, Keisha Ali responded, and other, you know, academics responded, and they were like, whoa, 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 you guys have to stop. And right. So they were able to silence, to point out how problematic it was, the way that they had not, that they were not engaging my material, they hadn't watched it, they were giving opinions that were, you know, like, and literally missing the whole point, because part of my point was privilege, right? Mm. Like, you're talking about something you have no experience with, and your opinion has become mainstream, what do you think that means? So it was really, really, it was so telling, and it was really problematic. And then others also responded, including non-binary scholars responded and pointed out how problematic it was that, you know, these senior scholars were responding to a junior scholar's content. One of them pointed out, for example, that the channel was introduced as a teaching resource, and then look what was happening instead. And then when I responded, yeah. I was able to point out that, you know, the discussion that just happened, well, if we can call it a discussion, that just happened here, is precisely why something like this is necessary. And when you share these videos in your classes, tell your students about this. Tell them, yeah. This is exactly what happened when this channel was shared in an academic listserv. These are people with PhDs who right. are supposed to be scholars of Islam. So that's another reason why I do what I do. Like it's the fact that stuff like that is just so unheard of, and it's a woman speaking, and it's a junior scholar speaking, and it's a brown woman talking about Islam in very authoritative ways, because I know what I'm talking about. I've done my research. And it was just really, really, it's disgusting the way that the patriarchy responds to us. So basically, my audience is Muslim, and it's non-Muslims. It's everybody. And for the Muslims, I want them to know that they have alternatives, that there is a way to practice Islam in a way that includes you, that loves you, that values you, that sees your struggles with patriarchal Islam as a form of jihad, as a form of justice for, you know, sort of struggling for justice. Mm-hmm. And then for the non-Muslim, I want them to say, for my non-Muslim audiences, I want them to see, you know, this is a Muslim woman who knows her stuff on Islam. Islam can look many different ways, but the opinions that you know more about, probably one, because as I tell my students, that opinion had more money. Somebody was sponsoring that opinion. That's how the majority view typically tends to win. So I want people to know the very human factor in religion. I want them to understand that we as humans, as scholars of religion, as readers of scripture, we make interpretive decisions about scriptures, about religious texts. What we decide is right or wrong is open to debate. It's never a fixed thing, and it changes with time, and it has changed with time. It's happening. It happens all the time. And one of the ways that these human concepts change is based on time and context and the individual in question. So who has power, who has privilege, etc. What I have done so far is primarily summarizing some of the most important books in the study of Islam and gender. I'm currently working on my book on sexual ethics and Islam. That's by Keisha Ali, whose scholarship I value. I think she's one of the most important people to exist, so highly recommended. And I've done Amina Wadud's book, Quran and Woman, you know, rereading the sacred text from a woman's perspective. I've done Leila Ahmed's book, Women and Gender in Islam. I've done Fatma Marnisi's book, The Veil and the Male Elite. So I provide summaries of books that are academic for the most part, mm-hmm. that may be inaccessible to people because they're expensive, if they are not all of them are, but expensive is a different term for everyone. I want people to know that this kind of scholarship exists, that the struggles that they're dealing with, because when I discovered Keisha Ali and Amina Wadud and Fatma Marnisi in 2007-08, mm-hmm. my life changed. And I'm trying to just sort of make that a lot more accessible. And I want to talk about it. And I want to say, here are the findings for people who don't have time to read the whole thing. And then I want them to, you know, sort of see them. I want them to hear their struggles recognized publicly, I guess.
This ties back to what you said at the very beginning to the first question, which was the value of humanities and the value of debate. And I'm so glad that you're doing this. At least there can be a recognition that the discussion is already happening. It's not something brand new. We're already having this discussion, participate in an informed and academic way, as opposed to the way that some people have responded to you, which is despicable. I'm sorry about that. But I do appreciate all this work that you're doing. I'm definitely going to put links to your YouTube channel so that if people want to use that for teaching resources, they can. And I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.